Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello there, and welcome to The Bodcast, Bustle's podcast for radical body positivity, fat acceptance, and visibility for all identities. I'm Marie Southard Ospina, and today I'm joined by the inimitable Virgie Tovar. She is an author, activist, and one of the nation's leading experts and lecturers on fat discrimination and body image. Virgie's anthology, Hot and Heavy, Fierce Fat Girls on Life, Love, and Fashion, which was published in 2012, was actually one of the first books I ever came across that tackled fat acceptance and brought together a myriad of voices to discuss weight-based discrimination. And in my opinion, she's continued to be one of the strongest, loudest, most touching voices of the movement. So we're going to chat with her about her work, as well as her recent critique on Ravishly on a recent episode of This American Life, which she was consulted for but didn't end up appearing on. So Virgie, thank you so much for talking to me today. For listeners who aren't super familiar with everything you do under the umbrella of fat activism, do you want to tell us a little bit more about your work?
I do a lot of lecturing at universities, especially around this issue, like just explaining what fat phobia is, how it affects our life, like what diet culture is and its intersections with things like racism and sexism and ableism. I also have this program called Babe Camp, which is a 4-week online course for people who are ready to break up with diet culture and kind of need a little bit of support in doing that. And it's kind of like this primer in, you know, understanding, again, like what diet culture is and why it is. Because, I mean, so many people are dieting and are super unhappy about it,
For sure.
They don't entirely understand why. I offer language and ideas and tools. And so that's something that I do a lot of. And then I think I do a lot of writing also. And I have like 2 columns. I write a lot about helping people deal with, you know, a culture that's completely saturated with fat shame, negotiating relationships and friendships that are like maybe people are having complications around because of these issues. I mean, I work probably primarily I work with women. And so there's a lot of like really intense intricacies of like diet culture that infiltrate women's relationships with their romantic partners, with their friends, with their coworkers. And I've found that they need a lot of support. We need a lot of support in
everybody needs so much support.
Yes. In like navigating and negotiating those things. So like my work in general is like, you know, kind of holistically being an activist.
I'm also really curious about your experiences publishing Hot and Heavy in 2012, before body positivity was a buzzword and before a lot of folks were a little bit more cognizant of the fact that size acceptance is a movement and that it's rooted in all these things like diet culture and fat phobia. What were the experiences you received to it like, be they negative or positive?
Yeah. I mean, so the book publishing journey was really interesting and I think very informative. You're right in the sense that there wasn't really a whole lot happening at the time online, you know? And so I want you to like go back with me in time. I think it was 2008. I go to see my friend and we're just having dinner. And she's doing her master's in social work and she has to do a final big project and she wants to do a body image kind of like repository blog journal thing. And so she's asking people to contribute these stories about their bodies and their relationship to their body for her final sort of master's thesis project. And she says, you know what? I would really love it if you wrote an essay. Why don't you write about being fat since you talk about it all the time? And I was like, what? I was like, what else? I was like, oh my God, I talk about it all the time. I just had like no self-awareness that I was using the word fat, that like my friends were totally set, like recognizing me as politicized around my fat.
So you were already using it in like positive or neutral connotations?
Yeah. Okay. Well, it was kind of like I was using it in this, I don't know if it was, it was definitely not neutral. I think it was very, it was, I'm such a reactionary person. I'm such a like scandalous, like a scandal driven lady in a lot of ways. I like to like really poke at the culture. That's just kind of something that's very, very, I feel like it's epigenetic. I'm like, I come from a line of shit kicking people. I'm using this phrase, I think at the time, mostly to kind of like jar people a little bit, because it's like, I feel like my life is being shaped so intensely by my fatness. And I just kind of want to talk about it. I want to be able to like explicitly sort of make visible that which is in that, which is like silent, you know?
Definitely.
Because it was like fat phobia had been silently, quote unquote, in a lot of ways, shaping my adult life. And it was like really frustrating and angering and in some ways gaslighting to not actually talk about it. So I think that's what inspired all that. So I ended up writing this essay called Fatties of the World Unite, which was like this manifesto. It was like a literally a blog post length manifesto where I'm like, guess what? I'm tired of all this dating crap. I'm tired of like fashion. I'm tired of, you know, and it was really, really a rant with no like silver lining, really. I was just being kind of like, this sucks. And fascinatingly enough, not a lot of people were doing that at the time. So the response to that one essay that like probably 20 people read was overwhelming, right? Yeah. Like, you know, my friend told me that at the they had a party to celebrate the project's completion, and she said a woman came up to her and wanted to tattoo the post onto her body, right? Because like she just felt totally visible and seen through the publication of my words. And so at around that time, I want to write a longer piece called Fatties of the World Unite. And so I decide, I like randomly, I'm living in New Zealand because I met this dude online. Like, it's a weird story. It's like I was working in radio. The radio show was podcasted, which was and this was like the big podcast boom, like when iTunes was like a thing, right? And so this dude in New Zealand heard the podcast, wrote me this long love letter. It was like, I've been dreaming of you since I was like 7. You're the woman of my dreams. So I was like random. I was living on and off in New Zealand dating this like dude, right? Like named Sam, and he was amazing and wonderful. So I'm in New Zealand, and if you haven't been to New Zealand, there's like nothing to do, which actually sparks a ton of creativity. I recommend anybody who's like creatively stuck to like move somewhere where there's nothing to do, because you get so much done, right? And I wrote a book proposal in like 3 days, and I was like, I really want to write this book. And you know, at this point, it's about 2009. I submit Fatties of the World Unite, the book proposal, to my current publisher. And I get an email back a few weeks later. She's like, I love your voice. This is really interesting. There's not a lot of manifestos in feminist publishing right now. I don't know if I'm going to get it past the marketing team, but whatever happens, you're good. Keep doing it. And so, you know, a month later, she's like, okay, guess what? The marketing team said that you're not going to be able to reach the market, which is marketing speak for nobody's going to buy this book. And so I go to graduate school. I start researching this. I start researching fat women. Like my research is entirely focused on fat women's lives, how fatness affects gender development over a lifetime. And I'm just going down the rabbit hole of fat activism because somebody found out I was studying this. This is how small the world was at the time. Like somebody found out I was researching fatness and was like, do you know this person? Have you gone to this conference? Have you done this? And it just kind of, and I would just say, yeah, like, I would say no, but then I'd be like, yes, I want to do it. Okay. Yes. I'll meet that person. Yes. I'll go to that conference. Yes. I'll do that thing. And through that process, I sort of landed with deep within, what at the time was a very queer fat activist movement. Mm-hmm. And so it was like incredible, right? Because these mostly femmes, like mostly ladies or feminine identified people, were doing this totally embodied fabulousness that I had never seen fat people do. And that was ultimately like what sort of pulled me in and like made it feel real for me. Yeah. And so once I had met all of them, I was like, I have to introduce the world to these people. So in 2011, I go back to the publisher. I'm like, check it out. This thing is about to blow up. You want to get on this right now because like these people are amazing and the world is about to find out about all of them. And you guys want to be the first people to publish like a collection by these amazing people. And so they got back and they were like, yep, you're right. And so
I mean, you were like, right. Like, how much has it blown up since?
Yeah, totally. And I just couldn't. Anyway, so it was like the anthology, the idea for the anthology really came out of the gesture that, like, though a manifesto is very powerful, I love manifestos, that that with this issue in particular, it was very important to have multiple authors, because when there's a single author, it's so easy to kind of like discount that you as an individual reading this work can do this too. And with an anthology, there's multiple, like in this book, in Hot and Heavy, there's 30 different people writing about how they did this thing. And I think it's so powerful to sort of, and this is like the power of the anthology, right? Like the collective voice, the community that becomes, you know, the support system that you need to make this very courageous choice. And in this culture, especially if you're a woman, it's such a courageous choice to choose not to diet, to choose not to like live under the oppressive body standards that are expected of women.
To conform. So I mean, speaking of which, Hot and Heavy had so many wonderful essays in there, as well as your own commentary. Do you happen to have a favorite excerpt you might want to read?
Yeah, I have so many favorites, but I actually want to read from the very first chapter in Hot and Heavy. And I want to tell you, I'm going to give you a little bit of background so that the paragraph I read makes sense. But you know, it was at the No Lose, which NOLOSE, like the Fat Queer Conference, that I really felt embodied as a fat person for the first time. And we would all sit around, you know, poolside and chat with each other. And one of the people I met at that conference was a woman named Erin, who goes by Cherry Tart. She's a burlesque performer in Seattle. And I was kind of just like, as a researcher, being like, hey, you know what? Like, what's your story? Like, how did you get here? You know, how did you get to this point? And she was like, well, I was in a really, really, really bad accident. And I'm going to read to you like this part, and then I'll talk a little bit more about Erin in a second, but this is going to kind of reveal what happened. So she's talking to the doctor, and he says, she's been like helicoptered out by, like, she's got the jaws of life from, she's like after a crash, jaws of life. She's being like helicoptered to a hospital. She is now in the hospital and, you know, she's conscious and the doctor is telling her this. He says, you're lucky you were carrying a little extra weight or you wouldn't be standing here. No broken bones, no internal bleeding.
Wow.
While I would not advocate going through a horrific crash to realign one's body priorities, that accident really changed how I looked at life. Not just in the lottery style, up on my accident karma kind of a way, but it also disabled my ability to truly hate on my body. My body had saved me, and more specifically, my fat had saved me. And so, like, she has this moment where the doctor is like, telling her that if she didn't have an airbag or anything, right?
Like, wow.
It was an old school, like Honda, I think. And the doctor is telling her that if she had not been fat, she would be dead. Because like her stomach was a buffer for her internal organs.
Yeah.
And I just, even just like reading you that, it still gives me chills because that story, right? That story never gets told. The story where like fat can be this amazing, beautiful, even life-saving thing. That story never gets told, even though hers isn't the only story like this, you know?
I remember in, I think it was fifth grade, a friend of mine in class, we were, how old are you in fifth grade? 10, 11. She was playing in the front yard of her home. This is suburban New Jersey. And a drunk driver lost control of the car as she was in the front, as my friend was, you know, in her front lawn. This driver lost control, hit her at about 50 miles an hour, I think it was. She was speeding on this like residential street, throwing this girl up into a tree, knocking her down. And it was a similar situation where she was told by multiple doctors that she would have died had she not been fat, had she not been carrying, quote unquote, an extra 70, 80 pounds or so. And, right. You know, we were 10, 11. Like these stories are real and we never hear about them, like you said.
Yeah. And I just remember, yes. And like, I remember, you know, listening to her story and thinking that has to open the book because it just fundamentally undermines this narrative, you know, this mythology of fatness as always something that is negative and that's health endangering, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And Hot and Heavy to me felt like such a work of fat activism rather than the kind of contemporary body positivity we're seeing a lot more of, since the latter is kind of something that many would argue has evolved into a very white, very cis, very able, very only marginally different to conventional beauty standards rhetoric. And a lot of folks argue that although Body Pos in its 2016 incarnation was born of fat acceptance and size acceptance, it's no longer catering to the more marginalized among us. You know, like the all bodies are good bodies mentality. We kind of are seeing praised a lot more by brands and campaigns and companies, so often forgets that all bodies do include super fat bodies, differently abled bodies, square and boxy fats, bodies of color, visibly queer trans bodies. And I'm wondering how you personally perceive this kind of divide between a work that is obviously so about fat acceptance versus contemporary body positivity, and how you kind of go about identifying yourself and placing yourself within those umbrellas.
Yeah, it's complicated for me to negotiate all of it. Like in on the one hand, right, like my concerns about people who very intensely align with body positivity versus fat positivity is that liberation, I should say, is that I don't. What's hard is I feel like it's a convoluted language. Mm-hmm. Body politics, the body positivity movement is kind of a convoluted, obscured language. And I think that's what's hard, right? Is like fat liberation is a clear demand. You know, there's a clear, like it's right there in the term, right? And I think with body positivity, you're like, what's the demand, you know? And it's sort of hard because I think that what my problem with it is that I think a lot of people are, it's easier for them to sort of co-sign on body positivity explicitly because it's unclear what the aim is. Mm-hmm. And I feel what's hard is that it gains traction based on the obscurity of its terms. And that's a big problem, right? Like, it's like, okay, and so, like, because I think that, and this is the problem, right, within feminism, like the body image conversation. And feminism has itself historically been very bad and very obscure about its stance on body politics. And I think that it's like, it's much easier to sign on to something that's vague, that isn't delineated. And I think kind of, unfortunately, that's where body positivity is. And like, I think what people are reluctant to do is to kind of co-sign on this idea that like all bodies, regardless of size, regardless of health status, deserve a life free of bigotry, period. You know, I think that people just can't, and I want to believe, and I don't mean to like reduce body positivity to like this infantilized political state, but I kind of believe that like sometimes body positivity can be a good introduction, a good middle step for somebody who is like completely unaware of anything and is still kind of trying to figure out where they stand on it as they weigh as they weigh the culture's sort of opinions and ideas about this issue, I think that's an okay landing place. It's an okay launching pad. I sort of expect people politically, and I mean, I have a lot of faith in people. I have a lot of faith that people who maybe right now identify as vaguely as body positive can become fat sort of liberationist. But yeah, I think like this change in the movement has been really interesting for me, and I'm actually like going to be writing an article about the ways in which like the sort of new body positive, like white cisgender, like you were mentioning, mm-hmm. this kind of dominant face or voice in the sort of movement now, how like they use a lot of explicitly queer symbols that come mm-hmm. from that very like, in fact, lesbian history of like fat activism, and they're kind of like using these symbols in a really interesting way, right? Like when these lesbians were doing what these women are doing now, what these straight women are doing now, they were doing it as kind of like a really explicit like FU to the culture. They were doing it as like, it was political, there were a lot of gestures within that. And now what I'm noticing is like a lot of these women are using the same symbols, but they're actually trying to gain respectability from the culture using the exact same symbols. And that kind of is like mind blowing to me, right? Yeah. Anyway, so all the thoughts.
For sure. I mean, to switch gears a little bit, I mentioned like initially, I'm so curious about your work lecturing on some of these issues of size discrimination and fat acceptance. My memories of school, albeit mostly like elementary and high school, mostly consist of like science teachers telling me I was going to die at 29 if I didn't have a lifestyle change. And I remember I think it was my sixth grade health and science teacher having like very obvious prejudices against the fat students, who at this point were myself and one fat boy in the class called Bobby, I believe. And she told him, like, in front of all these kids, that no woman would ever love a fat pig. And keep in mind, we were like 11 and 12. And the adults behind health classes at this point were so much more body shaming than the kids themselves. You know, do you have any experiences like that from school, like of just insane fat phobia at that age, or, you know, before college?
So pretty much the entirety of my education in fat shaming happened between age 5 and age 18. Mm. So going to school was an incredibly unsafe experience for me emotionally. For me, teachers were not so much the source of it, at least not overtly, right? Like I notice a lot of, especially my dude teachers, like mm-hmm. they certainly had kind of preferential treatment for the thinner women, the thinner girls in my classes. And it was very clear to me that it was happening, but like it was not overt, right? Yeah. So I would say that almost like pretty much all of it and 100% of the overt fat phobia came from my peers. And I want to be like really clear that the gender, like it was boys, right? Mm-hmm. Like it was like almost exclusively boys who were doing this.
Yeah. And if they had female friends, it had like spread, but I definitely remember boys often being the cause of it, and then like their friends of all genders chiming in too.
Right, exactly. You know, and I think it's important to kind of like really speak about the gendered nature of like body shaming, especially when we're younger, you know? I remember all I wanted to do was to kind of be invisible. Like I just wanted to disappear. I would wear very, very muted colors. Mm-hmm. I would wear like lots of layers. And it was a very rare day when I wouldn't be made fun of. And like, if I had, you know, a day where I wasn't made fun of at all, it would be like an intense success. It would be my idea of like, wow, I need to literally do, like, I would go home after school feeling so excited and so successful. And I would try to like I would try to map out what I had done that day that had made it so special and try to replicate it the next day.
Yeah.
And like, that was how rare like a day free of fat shaming was for me. And I think like legitimately, I mean, that's the kind of stuff that gives people PTSD, right? Like,
it really
kind
does. Of this,
like, and I think what's so difficult is like, you know, I associated, I mean, I loved school. I was like a nerd. And in a lot of ways, I had a really complicated, dysfunctional family. And I saw education as a way to get out of that. You know, I saw like college as my way out of my dysfunctional family, you mm-hmm. know, and to kind of like have this vehicle be so fraught, to have this thing that like brought me so much joy be at such a high emotional cost to me is so unfortunate. And in fact, it's like unconscionable, right?
Mm-hmm,
and I think
tragic.
What's hard is like a lot of fat people are just told to like ignore it and it will go away and whatever. And I'm like, no, like do not take the high road if you're an oppressed person. Like, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I mean, I wish I'd been told to snitch. I wish I'd been told to defend myself. I wish I'd been like taught comebacks, you know, like these are all like, I'm like, and I said this on like, you know, my friend's podcast a few months ago. And I was like, the high road is oversold to oppressed people. And I'm like, screw the high road. Don't do it, girl. Like, don't fall for the high road fucking rhetoric because it's like a trap, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, so speaking with like your lectures now, they tend to be more for college aged people, right?
Yes.
And right. What's that experience like?
It's amazing. Like most of the time, like, right, like, most of the time it's, like really new material for most of the people in the room. And they're really, really receptive. They're really into it. Right. Because like when I go in, I talk about my own life. I talk about the history of dieting as something that's like 200 years old that came mm-hmm. from, the mind of like this reverend who started this movement called the Dietary Reform Movement that has the exact same tenets and philosophy as modern day dieting. I talk about the recent study that found that fat discrimination shortens people's lives, that like it's in fact not these kind of like things that we think of. It's not the fatness itself. The culture tells us that it's fat that is killing us. And this study shows that it's actually the ongoing stress of surviving fat shaming all the time that actually shortens fat people's lives. I talk about the gendered nature of diet culture, the way that it has a history of like female subjugation. I build this case in a lot of ways that I think that they totally viscerally resonate with. And like, so it feels really special. I mean, occasionally I have like weird people who show up who are like, I mean, sometimes I have these like white Republican dudes who just like come, they want to be enraged.
They want to troll.
And I'm like, right. And I'm like, I'm staring, like I did a lecture recently in like Sonoma and there was this like one white Republican kid. And I was like, he was like visibly shaking from anger.
Oh my gosh.
I was like, and I was just like, oh, I just couldn't. And you know, and he had like clearly been formulating like a question. He came in with like kind of a rebuttal before I even started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, like a lot of, and of course, these like white Republican dudes want to shut me down based on like a health argument. And I'm like, well, I'm not an expert in health. Also, all that I'm saying is compelling, like also human rights. Like, I'm just like, mm-hmm. I'm not going to throw down with you and argue about this because I'm actually not invested in the health argument. So like, I have nothing, I'm not going to defend myself. And I don't feel like anybody else has to defend themselves around this.
No.
So it's like, they always come at me with the rebuttal always comes from the same place. And it always feels weird. I know.
Virgie, you are just too much of a proponent of obesity. You need to stop.
Exactly. No, but it's like, it's so funny to me where I'm like, in there, I know that in the culture's mind and in these like Republican dudes' minds, there is a direct line between what I'm talking about and health. And in my mind, it feels completely separate. I feel like I'm like, I just gave a lecture on oranges and you want to talk to me about a chair. I'm like, I don't know what, like, I have no idea. I have no expertise on chairs. Like, I just gave you an hour lecture on oranges. Like, why are you bringing this up?
Mm-hmm.
It just feels like in their minds, it's completely, they're like synonymous. And in my mind, I'm like, no, they're not. I'm talking about human rights. I'm talking about living a life free of stigma, and you're asking me essentially, well, who can I be mean to? That's what you're asking. Well, like, when people ask me health questions, they're like, well, if I can't be mean to fat, like, I have to be able to be mean to somebody. Like, who can I be mean to? And I'm just like, and I'm like, you're asking me for permission to be an asshole, and I'm simply not going to give it to you.
Yeah. Oh, it's nutty. So now that you've had, like, all these experiences teaching and kind of back in the education system, do you feel like, looking back on when you were in school and you were facing all this fat phobia yourself, speaking up and having all these comebacks to the fat phobia would have made things different?
Yes. I do. I mean, like, ultimately, right, like, yeah, like, yes and no, right? Because, like, what's hard about having comebacks and, like, it really still puts the onus on the individual, which I'm not an advocate of. Like, I mean, in a lot of ways, a lot of my work is about equipping individuals with tools about how to deal with fat phobia. And I mean, I love doing that. I also hate the fact that, like, all the tools are for the people who are already suffering. Like, I'm a big advocate of, like, people who are suffering need to be doing less work. Right. Yeah. So, like, ideally, my childhood, right, like, my childhood was the responsibility of the adults and the culture around me to make it safe for me. That was their job, not my job.
This is true.
You know, and so, like, I think what's hard is, like, yes, at the end of the day, with the culture that we know as it exists now and as it existed when I was a kid growing up, absolutely as an individual response, if I had been emboldened to defend my body, that would have been an incredible tool. Because I remember, you know, I was at one point, I was about to graduate from elementary school, and there was this one kid who had been relentlessly fat phobic, just, like, shamed everything, shamed my arm hair, shamed my fat body, like, just like everything was, he just, like, pointed out everything that he felt was disgusting about me. And finally I just hit a tipping point, and I spoke back, and then he never did it again, you know? Yeah. And again, it's like, I mean, I just think, you know, what if I'd done that multiple years before? Like, when parents ask me, like, how do I deal with my kid coming home crying? How do I deal with the fact they're experiencing so much fat shaming at school? One of the things I advocate for them is to, like, consistently have the same line that when your kids come to you, have your, like, body positive, like, fat positive thing that you tell them, and don't change it. I think what was hard for me growing up was that I got conflicting messages at home. Like, a lot of times my mom would be like, forget them, you know, you can use comebacks, you can, like, she would teach me comebacks and stuff like that, which I would sometimes use, and she would sort of tell me how beautiful I was and whatnot. But then sometimes when I came home and I was miserable, she would, like, advocate dieting, and she would advocate, like, eating disorder stuff, and, like, and I think it was like that. I mean, I don't want to blame it on my mom, like, but I think, like, for parents who are really invested in their children sort of not being completely, like, shattered by this, I don't know how to, I mean, I don't think it's the parent's responsibility, really. There's not a whole lot a parent can do, but insofar that a parent can do something, they can just have that consistent line, you know, like, this is, like, no, your body is, every body is a good body, like, you know, and I just sort of, anyway, so those are kind of, anyway, so yes, yes and no, right?
Yeah, so on to, like, current events. You recently wrote a piece for Ravishly on This American Life's new podcast episode, Tell Me I'm Fat, which, for folks who haven't listened to it, it featured Lindy West and Roxanne Gray, both of whom are very, very vocal about issues of size discrimination, as well as writer and comedian Elna Baker. Elna was there kind of talking about being a former fat person who underwent weight loss surgery and lost 110 pounds. She admitted on the podcast to taking Speed almost daily in order to keep the weight off. Her husband also made an appearance openly admitting that he probably wouldn't have fallen for her if she had been fat when they met. It was a really heavy, heavy hour of life. And, you know, you had some critiques about it, which you expressed on Ravishly. And I'm wondering if you can talk about them a little bit, as well as the reactions you received for critiquing that podcast.
Yeah. I mean, to begin with, I want to say that, like, I have a lot of bias going in because This American Life pre-interviewed me twice, like once about a year ago when they were originally thinking about doing an episode on fatness, and then again leading up to this episode. And I just sort of found like, and then they kind of, you know, like 2 months before it aired, they interviewed me, and then I got an email after they'd already created the episode kind of saying, you know, sorry, we didn't have, we had a time crunch. We had to like, we didn't end up having time to include personal stories. And it was kind of like weirdly, I mean, A, I didn't believe it. B, it was weirdly reductive. I'm like, I'm not giving you personal. I mean, yes, there's a personal story, but like, I'm giving you a grand critique, because I told them, I was like, you guys should, this episode should be focused on the fact that like, regardless of size or health status, a person deserves to live a life free of bigotry. Like, make the episode about the culture, make the episode about that phobia, you know? And so I kind of like, so to begin with, like I already kind of felt like this jilted, like used person whose time had been wasted. So that was like, in a lot of ways, my impetus, like I was already annoyed to sort of begin with to coming into it. Cause I just do not like people wasting my time, like hours and hours. So that's like that's the preamble. I took big issue with the framework of the episode, which was again, repeating the framework of the culture, kind of like where fat people, primarily fat women in this episode, or formerly fat women, are the ones who are on trial. They're the ones who are being observed. Our privacy is already always considered non-existent. We have to share these incredibly often humiliating or ingratiating, very, very traumatic sometimes stories in order to convince the culture that we're right, to convince the culture that like we deserve to be treated better. I take issue in a massive way with this kind of framework, which is kind of like the liberal framework of proving that we deserve, like proving any oppressed group deserves rights. And there's a very strong historical tradition of this. And I don't like it, right? Because it essentially requires that the oppressed person do all the labor. And then kind of like when the person who's in privilege decides they want to admit that this is actually a problem, then they get to kind of like remain. But until then, they get to kind of remain in the shadows, right? Like and not being named as complicit, not being named as like, you know, these problematic kind of like co-signers on this issue. And so that was it. And then like, for me, the fact that that Elna's story was the central story, I took issue with that as well. Like, not only because she's a formerly fat person, but because of, regardless of like what she said, regardless of the extremity of the sort of like things that she's done in order to lose weight and to stay thin, regardless of the fact that her husband admitted that he wouldn't love her if she wasn't fat, which are all very sad and very awful things. Despite that, she still acted as a success story, right? Because like a success story for women in this culture is that you internalize the fat phobia and the sexism that the culture has taught you, and you enact that understanding by making your body as small as possible, and then reaping the benefits of that obedience, right? Like, and the benefits, quote unquote, of that obedience are things like marriage, like heterosexual marriage, right? Like, and you know, like certain kinds of jobs and certain kinds of clothing, right? And so, like, I think that even in perhaps the producer's mind, and I think even in Elna's mind, she was sort of maybe acting as like this foil to the weight loss success story, but that's not actually what happened, right? Like, that's not how it actually landed, I think, for a lot of people. And I think especially for people who are deep in the cycle of disordered eating and dieting, they did not hear that story and think, wow, I should probably stop doing this. I think they thought, wow, maybe I should try this new method called, you know, amphetamines, right? Like, I mean, I just sort of think like that was what the story effectively did. And in terms of the reaction, I was surprised in a few different ways. Like, I was surprised by the backlash, primarily from white women who themselves had lost a lot of weight, who argued that I was mischaracterizing Elna and that I was like insinuating was the actual word they used, that she was a drug addict. It was like almost, I mean, I'm like, I think it was different people. It might have been the same person just doing it over and over with different names, but like the verbiage was almost identical. Regardless of whatever the case was. So I was really amazed by like how they had perceived my critique. And again, my critique was largely about the framework, right? Like, I thought Elna's story had problems. But, like, the other interesting thing on the other end were the women who wrote me privately. So the women who were lambasting me were doing it publicly, like on Twitter or Facebook, who had problems with the argument. And the women who were supportive of the argument, many of them wrote me privately in email. And so I had a few women write me and say, thank you for writing that. Thank you for, like, for unveiling the lie. And a few people who had relationships to the show beyond listenership. I don't want to get too specific. People had relationships to the show, wrote me and thanked me and said, like, you know, I wish that it had, you know, I wish that, like, the show hadn't gone the way that it did. And anyway, there's so many, like, very, very private things I want to tell you, but, like, they're kind of, I think they could, like, great confidentiality.
No, of course.
But the point being that, like, people in close proximity to the show and people who were featured in the show wrote me and thanked me for writing that.
It's unfortunate to me that an episode that could have had a lot of potential to, like, inspire and really talk about fat phobia and dissect it and ended up just triggering so many people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's also funny. I had I talked to Saray Walker, who wrote Dietland, on the show a few weeks ago, and she was saying how a lot of women and very often thin women have come to her after reading and really doubted some of the experiences the protagonist goes through in the book, the protagonist being Plum. So Plum goes through this series of dates at one point, and all the men largely insult or belittle her for her body. So a lot of readers have gone to Saray and said, you know, that would never happen. Like, a man wouldn't just, like, walk out on a fat woman on a blind date and, like, tell her that she's a pig. And obviously it does happen, and it happens, you know, it happens frequently, but it doesn't always. And I'm wondering how you think kind of the narrative of, like, Elna and her husband factors into all of this. Did you feel like it kind of contributed to that idea? Or, yeah, how do we deal with that?
It's important to see alternative narratives where, like, that behavior is not seen as universal. Mm-hmm. It's seen as deeply problematic. And, like, even though it might be something that is very common, that, like, that does not become impetus for us to change our bodies because it's an unchangeable sexist world. I think that's what's hard with some of it, right? Like, it's so important to tell these stories, to tell the truth about, like, how fat, what it's like being a fat woman dating, like the kind of sexism that women experience, right? Like, in dating, right? And I think, and the very specific way in which in heterosexual dating, men are taught to treat women's bodies as commodities that can improve their social standing. That's all a problem that's very real. I think what's difficult is then the takeaway that people have from that is, okay, there's no, you know, I have to change because the culture isn't going to change. And I'm like, no, right? Like, that's not the takeaway. Like, the takeaway for me is, like, lambasting people who do this, being incredibly and openly critical of a culture that that promotes this, and, like, refusing to fuel it, right? Like, refusing to pay into it.
Absolutely.
And so that's the hard part for me is I'm like, are there dudes, like, and to take it within a hetero context, are there dudes who are amazing, who don't, like, who know that it's not their right to demand what their partner looks like, who, like, have respect for women who, like, actually are good at being humans? Absolutely, right? And, like, the people who don't do that, they are not your, like, they're not your people, right? And I think that's what's so important is, like when I talk to people, even people in terms of, like, platonic friendships, women who are like, well, there are these people, I have these friends who are, like, really fat. I'm like, they're not your people. Those fat phobic people aren't your people, right? And, like, we need to stop pretending and stop acting like this is the way society is and it's immutable. We need to start expecting that, like, we need to move away from a paradigm where men feel that they own their partner's bodies. And I think vice versa, right? Like, I think we need to stop buying into this idea that, like, our partner's primary purpose is to increase our social capital, because that's some, like, capitalist bullshit right there, you know?
Absolutely. Wow. So, Fergie, thank you. Thank you so much for your words and your time and just the continued fight for to ending diet culture, to ending fat phobia, and to just making people feel a little more human.
Yeah, of course, of course. Thank you for having me.
So, Fergie, if listeners want to find you and your work and everything you're up to, how do they go about that?
Easiest way is to go to my website, virgietovar.com, V-I-R-G-I-E-T-O-V as in Victor, A-R.com, or you can find me on Instagram at virgietovar.
Sweet. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can find us on Acast, our awesome podcast network, and subscribe on iTunes and SoundCloud.